From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, singer-songwriter Shelby Lynn. She's receiving rave reviews for her latest CD, which is a hybrid of country, rock, and southern soul. It's the sixth album for this Alabama-born singer, but it's her first one away from Nashville. Also, Murray Taylor, the oldest active smoke jumper. Smoke jumpers are firefighters who are parachuted into otherwise inaccessible places to fight wildfires. And book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews the new novel, An Obedient Father. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Frank Stacio. State Department spokesman says both sides at the Mideast peace talks are making unflagging efforts. Secretary of State Madeleine Albright is filling in while President Clinton attends a summit in Japan. The president is attempting to speak and ready to speak at a peace monument in Japan where world leaders are gathering for that economic summit. Thousands of protesters are gathered outside the U.S. base in Okinawa. Demonstrators say they want the U.S. to send its troops home. For the ninth day in a row, temperatures have topped 100 degrees in Texas. State officials blame the heat for 19 deaths. From member station KERA in Dallas, Bill Zeeble has more.
The majority of the heat-related fatalities occurred in the county that includes Houston. The remaining deaths were spread over five different counties. While officials have distributed hundreds of fans and air conditioners across the state, they also urge people who have fans to use them. Low-income residents sometimes refuse, hoping to reduce their electric bills. The sizzling weather has also prompted more than 130 Texas cities to impose water restrictions, especially in regions where drought conditions have persisted now for several years. Forecasters predict weekend changes may bring cooler temperatures in North Texas and possibly even some rain. For NPR News, I'm Bill Zeeble in Dallas.
Efforts by congressional Republicans to persuade President Clinton to sign a marriage penalty tax cut bill are apparently not bearing fruit. Senate Democratic leader Tom Daschle says he's been told by White House officials the president will veto the latest bill. The measure would cut taxes for millions of American couples by $89.8 billion over 5 years. The vote 271 to 156, that's not enough to override a veto. Republicans say the tax cut is the right way to use some of the growing surplus. Democrats say the bill gives too much away to the wealthy. Stocks rose sharply today after the Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan testified on Capitol Hill, suggesting the economy is slowing to a sustainable pace. NPR's John Itzde reports.
Greenspan said that evidence of a slower growth in consumer spending indicates demand may be moving into line with the economy's ability to produce. He said if that continues, it would lower the risk of a surge in inflation. His remarks suggest that Fed policymakers are less likely to raise interest rates at their August meeting, which pleased investors. Greenspan acknowledged that analysts disagree on whether the slowdown in spending growth is a temporary pause or whether it will be more long-lasting, as the Fed would like. But it was significant that he spent most of his time offering evidence that the slowdown will be persistent and help put the economy on a more sustainable growth path. Greenspan also expressed concern about tax cuts and spending proposals in Congress that would eat into the federal budget surplus. John Itzde, NPR News, Washington.
The Dow was up 147 points today, and the Nasdaq finished 129 points higher. You're listening to NPR News. The FBI will be looking into a murder in a small West Virginia town. The move comes hours after the victim's parents met with Deputy Attorney General Eric Holder. The case involves Arthur J.R. Warren, a gay black man who was beaten to death July 4th, then run over by a car to make it look like a hit and run. Two 17-year-old white cousins have been arrested in Marion County, but the family and activists fear they'll be treated as juveniles. They believe the case is a clear-cut hate crime. The president of Burundi is urging changes in a draft plan to end his country's civil war. The plan's been proposed by former South African President Nelson Mandela. It's being discussed at a summit in Tanzania. The BBC's Chris Simpson reports.
Mr. Mandela himself has acknowledged there are two key questions which have still to be resolved. Who will direct a transition period of over 2 years, which will take Burundi into its first election since 1993? And how can a lasting ceasefire be put in place? On the transition issue, several Hutu political parties have already vetoed any extension of Mr. Buyoya's own presidency. At present, there are clear divisions amongst peace talks participants on whether a ceasefire should come before a peace agreement or vice versa. It is generally accepted that peace will only come if the rebels agree to put down their arms. But one rebel movement, the Forces for the Defense of Democracy, the FDD, has only just been brought into the talks. The other main group, the National Liberation Forces, or FNL, has so far remained outside the peace process.
BBC's Chris Simpson. A ringing cell phone may have led to the crash that injured several people on a Kansas City bus. Police say the driver reached for her cell phone and ran a red light, smashing into a Metro bus yesterday. I'm Frank Stachow, National Public Radio News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, bringing NovaSoy brand isoflavones to consumers throughout the United States, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Shelby Lynn started her recording career in country music. She got off to a promising start in 1988, recording a duet with country star George Jones. Then she made a couple of country albums, followed by albums of Western swing and torch songs. But not much happened with her albums or her career. She's changed direction on her new CD, I Am Shelby Lynn, and now her career is taking off. The recording is a hybrid of country, rock, and southern soul. In the LA Times, it was described as a contender for Album of the Year. In Entertainment Weekly, the CD was described as living up to the description that Tammy Wynette once gave of Lynn, the best voice in country music. Before we meet Shelby Lynn, let's hear a track. This is a song she co-wrote with her producer, Bill Bottrell. It's called Why Can't You Be?
Scared of loving 'cause it might feel good. You wanna get it like you know you should. What the hell's wrong with living without the blues? You stand convicted. You stand accused. You're so conflicted and abused.
I want to welcome you to Fresh Air. Shelby Lynn, what's behind the change in direction in this album?
I wrote all of the songs, first of all. Mm-hmm. Big change from my early career where I just recorded songs that were submitted to me. That's kind of the Nashville way. And I really wasn't interested in doing a lot of songwriting at that time. So after making five records in Nashville, I just wanted to change. I wanted to do something different.
So how did you start heading in a new direction? What steps did you take?
Well, the songs started coming, really, on their own. And they weren't really Nashville material. And I didn't have a clue what I was going to be doing with them. But they were coming. And I just eventually, you know, after spending six more months in Nashville, after living there off and on for 8 years or so, I just decided I would move back to Alabama and find my roots again and hopefully find someone that would want to do a record with me that understood making something real.
Is that what happened?
Yeah, I was interested in working with Bill Bottrell, and I sought him out, and he was interested, and his wife found I sent her a demo, actually, I had made in my living room, and she heard it and liked it. So she talked him into having a meeting, and then we hooked up and started working immediately.
And Bill Bottrell had produced Sheryl Crow.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you said this is the first album where you were actually writing the songs yourself. Did you think of yourself as a songwriter before?
No, not like I do. You know, I guess I'm a songwriter now, but you know, I just never really put much emphasis into it because I've always kind of been a singer first and performer. But I couldn't help it. The songs just kind of wanted to come out, and it was a natural thing, so it had to be done, I guess.
Now, how did you and your producer, Bill Bottrell, think through what kind of production style you wanted for the new CD?
Well, we just took it song by song, because they're all different, and let the music find its way, really. I mean, every cut started out with the vocal and my guitar, and then we built a record around it. Yeah, you know? And it just kind of took shape as we went along. We never had any plans making the record at all. We just wanted each individual song to have its own life.
Let's listen to another track from I Am Shelby Lynn. This is I Thought It Would Be Easier, written by Shelby Lynn and Bill Bottrell.
I always thought it would be easier after you've gone. Thought I could pull myself together and do fine on my own. Sometimes I do all right, then I remember how I dreamed it, how I needed it. I thought it would be I thought it would be easier. They never told me I'd be lonely, torn up and wasted. But when you saw something else in life, you couldn't wait to taste it.
Music from the new CD by my guest, Shelby Lynn. You grew up in Alabama in a small town. Would you describe the town for us?
Well, there's no town.
It's, it's too small really, to be a town.
There is no town there. It's 30 minutes from anything. There was one little general store market type vibe where we could get gas and things like that. But I grew up in the woods. Pine trees and a lot of land, always some animals around, and my family, which consisted of my mother, my father, and my sister. So that was it, and a lot of music. So that's, I'm not kidding, it's the middle of nowhere, population about, you know, maybe 700 by now.
What was the school like where you went to?
It was about, like I say, 30 minutes away, and, my mother would drive us halfway and where a school bus would pick us up, and we'd ride into town, and sometimes we'd ride home with her from work, and we sang together in the car, and that's how we learned to sing harmony together, and you know, it was kind of that way, you know. Not much city folk where I'm from.
What kind of songs did you sing in the car?
Oh, we would do everything from Everly Brothers to old 40s pop and Bob Wills songs and anything that was current on the radio that we liked, you know.
Did your mother ever perform?
Oh, nothing professional, but she was a pretty good singer and good looking and played a little guitar and, you know, just pretty talented, pretty well-rounded as far as knowing what was the difference between good music and bad music. I'm proud to say that she taught me that.
Your father was a teacher, and I think he did do some performing, music.
Yeah,
performing.
He always had kind of a honky-tonk band. He was a guitar picker, and yes, he was a school teacher, an English teacher. Graduated from Auburn University and taught some school and picked up the guitar. And about when I was seven, he taught me three chords, and I learned the rest on my own.
Now, could you see any national performers when you were growing up? Were there any venues for them to play?
Mobile, Alabama was closest we could get to anything that was big enough city to, you know, maybe see a concert. And, shoot, I was old for so a concert. Old meaning probably 14 or something. And that was like a Reba McEntire concert or something, Mobile. So it was hard to get out of those woods, but now growing up, I miss them sometimes.
You were born in 1968. In the 60s, there was the whole like Muscle Shoals scene in Alabama, a recording mm-hmm. studio where a lot of people, including Aretha Franklin, came
right.
to perform. And I'm wondering if there was anything left of that when you were growing up, or whether you were too remote from it to matter anyways.
I think I was too far away from it. I don't know anything about that, really.
Mm-hmm.
Muscle Shoals has got a history, but I don't know anything about it. My goal was to get to Nashville and be, Tammy Wynette as soon as I could get there.
You got to Nashville?
Yeah.
At, what, age 18?
18, yeah.
And you were on a talent show. I haven't seen the show called Nashville Now.
It's not a talent show. Actually, it's one of, like, a country variety show.
Oh, okay.
Or he would interview stars, and then, you know, that's kind of the show to be on in Nashville at that time.
Uh-huh.
And I had done a demo, and they put me on just by hearing a demo, and, got laryngitis and got a record deal.
You had laryngitis while you performed?
Yeah, can you believe it? I think I got so nervous. Everything flipped out on me, but Billy Sherrill was watching, and he wanted to do a record with me, so I said, okay, I have time. Quite a dream.
Well, Billy Sherrill had produced George Jones and Charlie Rich.
Right, right. Tammy Wynette.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
Tanya Tucker. Tons of great, great country pop music.
What did he hear for you? What kind of arrangements did he make for you? What kind of songs did you get?
We did a couple of covers. Old type tunes. The record I made with Billy was really kind of old fashioned, you know. It kind of had an old Nashville feel. So when I turned it into the record company, which was CBS at the time, they said, this won't do. It's too old fashioned. So now we need to put some pop cheese on here. So they changed producers on me, and Billy's work is on the first album. But they were never singles or anything like that. So you know what I mean? It was kind of, I knew at that time, being it was my first record, I knew that it was going to be totally different than I had ever imagined it, because it wasn't really about the music, it was about the hits. And, I immediately started bucking the system.
So you were unhappy with the way it sounded?
Well, it was little dinky songs about secretaries, and I'm not really interested in that kind of thing. So it made me mad, and I've been trying to live up to my reputation ever since.
So what did you do when you got mad? Did you complain to the record company, or?
There's no telling. You know, with all the stories, I'm beginning to even believe them. Some of those stories they've said about, you know, they've said terrible things, like I've pulled guns on people. That's so crazy. But no, you know, I don't have a problem letting anyone that's supposed to be working with me know that I'm unhappy about something if I am, because there's no need in wasting time, not with what I do.
Now, you've had, I think, 5 country CDs before your new CD.
Right.
And on the photograph of each of the album jackets, you're a little different.
Yes.
What are some of the different images you've had on your album covers?
Well, you know, I don't believe in images, but I think it's about a gal that started out making records at 18, that's pretty still, you know, pretty much an infant still to be in the music business. And on all of these album covers, I've watched myself grow into a woman that I finally like. So it just happens to be out there for the public to see, you know. Unfortunately, you know, hairstyles do change.
My guest is Shelby Lynn. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. My guest is Shelby Lynn. She has a new CD called I Am Shelby Lynn. She grew up in Alabama and started her recording career in Nashville when she was 18.
I guess you're one of the people who didn't grow up in a band that played the local bars or Holiday Inns dances.
No, not really. I was too young. By the time I had got to Nashville, I still wasn't old enough to get in the bars. So it was a good thing I had a record deal, I guess.
But that means that you started performing professionally without any, like, high school prom kind of experience or Holiday Inn kind of experience. It must have been terrifying.
Oh, no, I've never been terrified. I did all of my rehearsing at home in front of a mirror with a hairbrush. So it was kind of a natural thing. I was ready to do it all my life. I mean, I've just been waiting. I had been waiting and waiting. There was nothing else in the cards for me.
So you had enough confidence just from...
Oh, yeah.
Knowing that you had it in you.
Yes. And I had done, you know, maybe a school talent show or two, you know, but I'm talking maybe one or two. There weren't many. And we have these things back home called Fiddler's Conventions. And it's all acoustic music, mainly bluegrass music. And my sister and I would enter, like, the vocal group competition and sing together. And I would be, like, 9, and she'd be, like, 5. And I'd play a ukulele guitar, and we'd sing Blue Suede Shoes and Tea for Texas and stuff like that. But that was about all the performance experience I had ever had. I just knew that that's what I wanted to do.
Would you feel like
I had to do it?
Would you feel like doing a few bars from one of those songs?
Well, it would go like this. Very simple.
Tea for Texas, tea for Tennessee. Tea for Texas, tea for Tennessee. Tea for Thelma, a gal who made a wreck out of me. Well, I'm going where the water tastes like cherry wine. I'm going where the water tastes like cherry wine. 'Cause the Georgia water, it tastes like turpentine. All women make a fool out of me.
That would be about it.
I was waiting to see if you're going to do the yodel or not.
I never was much of a yodeler.
That's a great Jimmie Rodgers song. Did you grow up listening to a lot of his stuff?
Well, yeah, I love Jimmie Rodgers and Hank Williams and Bob Wills, and that is what we grew up around, yeah.
So did you have mostly country radio where you were, country radio stations?
The only station we could pick up was about 100, well, you know, 60 miles away. So, yeah, we had a...
The only station?
Well, country station.
Okay.
We had other stations, too, but we didn't really listen to it. My sister did, and then I got into it sometime. I don't remember when. But I was always been a country listener because I wanted to perform it, and that's what I wanted to be.
Mm-hmm. So what's it like now that, you know, you spent so much of your life wanting to perform country music, you gave it a shot and decided that that wasn't really you after all, and what you're doing is more of a hybrid now?
Yeah, well... I think I just realized that I would have to do country music outside of where I was because I don't really hear a lot of country music too much anymore, and I feel like that there's a song on my album, my new album, that's more country than anything I ever cut. So you know, I'm always doing country music. I just mix it in with my soul music and everything else I like too. You know, it's good to have the freedom to not have to do a certain kind of thing, because I hate boxes.
Which is the song that you think of as more country than any of your previous country songs?
On this album?
Yeah.
It would be Looking Up. I probably Looking Up.
Would you do a few bars of that?
Sure, let's do a few bars of it. Smoking and thinking of things to do since you're gone. Sitting lonely,
can't even get stoned. Taking a breath of a feeling that once lived in this house. Laughing and dying at the mirror in the hall. Talking to myself, a memory, don't remember at all, babe. The last thing you told me was the first thing that brought on these clouds. I'm looking up for the next thing that brings me down.
That's probably the country's thing on the record these days.
Well, the hook is very country. I'm looking up for the next thing that brings me down.
Yes.
But, you know, you don't have a country arrangement for it.
Well, I guess, I don't know. You know, Jimmy Webb's a big influence on my songwriting. I appreciate the way he puts a lyric down, but his melodies are so great. So I have to say that we had those melodies in mind with this tune here.
Shelby Lynn will be back in the second half of the show. Her new CD is called I Am Shelby Lynn. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Heaven knows this ain't no Margaret Mitchell, where the oak tree meets pines. I know it might sound kind of simple, Lord, but it's mine, oh, it's mine. Thought I heard a log man cutting timber down a Mississippi line. I'm up the old Tom Bigby River, high as a pine all the time. Elegant on les bateaux passant, perdant la flotte avec du vent.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From BEA, an e-commerce transactions company providing end-to-end solutions for the development and deployment of e-business applications, BEA.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, parachuting out of an airplane into a wildfire. We talked to smoke jumper Murray Taylor, who's been fighting fire since the mid-60s. Marin Corrigan reviews the new novel, An Obedient Father, and we continue our conversation with singer-songwriter Shelby Lynn. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with singer-songwriter Shelby Lynn. Her new CD, I Am Shelby Lynn, is a hybrid of country, rock, and southern soul. She grew up in Alabama and started her recording career in Nashville. Before you moved to Nashville when you were about 18, there was a tragedy in your family that I know you don't like to talk about. Your parents, who were divorced, were having a big fight, and your father came by the house, shot and killed your mother, and then used that gun to kill himself. You and your sister saw it happen. I'm wondering if that made you feel like it was necessary to move. You know, you went to Nashville not long after that. Did that make you feel like you had to start a new life?
No, I mean, I just, you know, what do you do? You do what you have to do. You wake up and you get up and you walk around. There's no plans. Who the hell makes plans after that?
Like, you saw this happen. Did you... You and your sister were teenagers. Did you know what to do? Who to call?
You know, all I know is we did it. We survived. We are survivors. It's no big deal. I mean, it's over with. It's so old and it's so gone, mm-hmm. and it is with me. But you know, I can't change any of it. And I don't know what. I mean, how do you know what to do? You just do it.
Did you feel like you understood at all what had come over your father?
No, I mean, I can't understand a man. I can't understand a man's thinking. I don't care if he's your father or not.
Was he drunk
at
the time?
It's harder to... Pardon me?
Was he drunk at the time?
I don't believe he was. I think that, you know, maybe people get to a point and they just break.
I think a lot of your fans assume that because this was so horrible and so tragic and because you witnessed it, that it must be the central formative thing that happened to you, and that your songs must relate to it, and that your emotion when you're singing must relate to it. Do you think that would be, from what I'm hearing you say, it sounds like you think that would be a false impression.
Well, I mean, you know, everybody has to compare anything great with some tragedy. So that's the way it is. I write songs because I'm good at it. I'm a singer because that's what I was born to do. My dead parents don't have anything to do with my songwriting. Now, you know what? I think what happened to me will always be with me, and it has more to do with who I am as a person. But I don't rely on the fact that a terrible thing happened to write songs, because I have my own living to do, and I'm not living through their deaths.
Well, I understand you did write a song called The Sky Is Purple that related to the murder-suicide, but you left it off the album.
Right.
Why'd you leave it off?
Because I don't want to sit here like this and talk about it every time. That's why.
Right, sure. Okay. you are singing the John Lennon song, Mother.
Sometimes.
In concert sometimes you sing it.
Yes.
How did you decide to add that to your repertoire?
I love the song. I'm a John Lennon freak. And you know, I can relate. So I love the simple content of the song, but the strong message, and it's so personal. And you know, it's kind of fun to perform it.
Well, it's a real primal scream type of song. How do you handle the screaming without hurting your throat?
I just don't worry about things like that. I just go with feelings, and whatever happens, happens.
Does it hurt your throat?
No. Hasn't yet.
Good.
Hasn't yet. It probably hurts a lot of people's ears.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Shelby Lynn, her new CD is called I Am Shelby Lynn. Here's her song, Leaving.
Well, I guess this is it, babe. Reality. No need in putting it off anymore. Just turn away and let me walk out the door. You thought you had it all figured out, but baby, you don't know what love's about. It's time for me to spend some time alone. I'm tired of trying to make this your happy home. I'm leaving. Sad. This time is for good. I
I'm leaving sad, and you can't make mistakes. I'm tired of hurting, this ain't no good anyway. I'm leaving.
Coming up, smoke jumping, fighting forest fires in remote areas by parachuting in. This is Fresh Air. Murray Taylor is a smoke jumper. He fights wildfires in remote regions by parachuting into the periphery of the fire. He's been at it since the mid-60s, and now at the age of 59, is the oldest practicing smoke jumper. He's jumped fires in 7 western states, Canada, and Alaska, where he's based during the fire season. He has a new memoir based on his experiences called Jumping Fire. This has been a bad fire season, but his season got off to a slow start. In late April, the Bureau of Land Management placed a moratorium on smoke jumping while it investigated the accidental death of a smoke jumper caused by a faulty parachute. The moratorium was lifted July 10th. I asked Murray Taylor to describe what he's looking for when he's looking down on a fire from the air.
A fire usually is headed in some direction. Due to the topography, it's burning uphill, or due to the wind, it's burning to the west or whatever. And we look at the fire in 4 different parts. There's the tail back at the back end of the fire, and then there's the head up in the end where the wind is blowing it. And then, so looking from the tail, there's the left flank and the right flank. And we always discuss fires in terms of what we see on the left flank, the right flank, what the head looked like it was doing, and how cool it was back at the tail. We typically begin to search for, in the air as we fly around, some opening, some clearing, some little bit of a meadow, maybe kind of a brush patch in the timber, where near the tail, preferably downhill from it, so that the fire couldn't have a tree fall down below us and the fire come up from below us. And the spotter will come back after he's discussed that with the pilot, and we'll select that, the spot, and then we'll jump down there near the tail somewhere.
Do you feel the heat of the fire when you're parachuting down?
Sometimes. I know one time I did something spontaneously, and I think if anybody could have seen it from my perspective, they would have judged it to be completely foolish, if not outright crazy. I was coming in on a landing at a certain angle, looking at a sort of a rocky slope on a steep ridge, and I was going to shoot high. The way the wind was buffeting around, I was going to overshoot the spot and maybe clear the ridge and then drift way on down the other side. And the only thing I could do, I just turned really hard to the right and made an S-turn right out over the forest. And the part that I flew out over, I was probably about 300 feet above it, but there were flame links down in the forest that were as completely as tall as the canopy, and the trees were 100 feet tall. And so for just maybe 10 or 15 seconds, I was directly out above a totally involved, completely catastrophic burning forest. And I depended on the drive of that parachute to be able to drive back off of that and get back at a better angle and come in on the jump spot, right? And it worked out just fine.
Is that the closest you've ever come to landing in a fire?
No, I've actually landed in fires, but they've been sort of cool, you know. By the time, every now and then you'll get buffeted over and maybe pushed into an area where it's not really life-threatening, but it's maybe put some burn holes in your canopy, and it's an embarrassment that you landed in the fire and really uncomfortable, but I don't. Smoke jumpers have never landed in a fire where they were burned from the jump.
Do you think of fires as being alive?
I noticed that they seem to act like they're alive, and I've heard other jumpers say it's like an animal or a living creature, but I know they're not alive. I know they're mindless. I know they would turn and come after you with no more hesitation, you know, than it takes to burn up a bush. They would burn a whole crew. So they what fire has is a predictable behavior. You can, and experienced firemen look at a fire, they know immediately what to do because they look at it, they look at the stage of development that it's in, they know what it will probably do next if the wind comes up, if the temperature goes up, or if the smoke breaks through an inversion, or if it burns around in a south hill side, which is warmer and drier. So experienced firemen recognize and are quite familiar with the behavior of fire as it builds from just as big around as a campfire until it builds into a blow-up condition. And so because of that, you can sort of interpret what it's doing, and in most cases you can sort of anticipate what it's doing. But it does have this awesome, powerful allure to it. It's beautiful, and it's one of nature's great wonders at work, and we enjoy being close to something that beautiful and that powerful.
Did you ever have a fire come after you? You know, like the wind shifts its direction in your direction, and suddenly the territory that you were on, which had been safe, is no longer safe.
Yes, I have. That's happened a half dozen times in my 35 years of firefighting. Surprisingly, the last two closest calls I've had have happened in the last 3 years. I had a close call in 1997 where that very thing happened, and the situation deteriorated so rapidly that the crew was right on the verge of collapsing all form of organization, that people were going to run for it on their own, which is sort of a desperate condition to be in, because a quarter of a mile of fire line just stood up and suddenly burned across our line, burned our hose, and cut off our route to our safety zone. And then it happened again just south of Delta last summer, the most radical fire behavior that many of us had ever seen in Alaska. It was a combination of strange two events happened simultaneously. The fire was about 40 acres. It suddenly blew up on the head because it was in that time of the afternoon where the heat was maximized, and it had preheated a lot of fuel, and suddenly it stood up with a big wall of flame about 80 feet tall out on the head, pushed a huge, giant smoke column way up into the sky. And then the typical wind pattern there around Delta is that this wind blows north through Isabel Pass every afternoon. And suddenly we had a 30 to 35 mile an hour wind hit the fire. And when that did, it bent the smoke column over. You could see the smoke column laying over, and on both sides were these weird-looking braided columns of smoke kind of looping up the side. And then suddenly that wind pushing against that column spawned two counter-rotating vortexes. And so suddenly we had this terrible roar out inside the fire. We couldn't see it, and we were yelling, "What's that roar? What's that roar?" And we started evacuating back down the line, and the crew on the far side, on the west side, they had to abandon. Well, they had to run back up this cat line where this tractor was working, and then they ran into the burn, and the vortex over there actually hit one of the guys and burned him fairly badly. On our side, this terrible roar was in the burn, and you could see this huge cloud of brown and gray ash just swirling out in the middle, about 100 feet in diameter. And then you saw this snaky kind of a gray snake going up into the sky, and the roar suddenly increased, and the vortex came out of the black into the green, and then the ash was gone, and it revealed a cylinder about 30 feet in diameter that was kind of pink and orange, and it was a tornado of fire. And we'd seen dust fire devils before, and everybody's seen those in regular fires, and they usually aren't that big. They're smaller. I mean, they can pick up logs that are 10 feet long and a foot in diameter and spin them up into the air and even carry them away. But this thing was something more. I don't know. The velocity at the edge of it had to be in excess of 150 miles an hour.
How did you get out of it?
Well, I got out of it. You know, I was the closest to it when it came out of there. It kept coming closer to me. And the way the rest of us were, the other guys ran for this creek. And I happened to be just the closest, and the darn thing was dancing around like they do those, you know, they kind of weave around one way or another. And it seemed like every direction I went, that was the way it was coming. And when it got within about 30 feet of where I was, then I turned and started to run. I knew I had to run some more, and this thing was throwing sparks out in all parts around the perimeter, and the second those sparks hit, they just became running fire. And so that quickly, I was surrounded in running and fire, and I was looking for a water hole to dive in, and the first one I saw was just a mud hole because it's been really dry last summer. And then I had that terrible moment of recognition that firefighters think about once in a while, where what you're seeing is sort of a nightmare, and it's your worst fear come true. Now you're surrounded by fire, and you think that maybe this is the time. Maybe you've stayed one season too long, and maybe one fire too long, and maybe, in fact, your career is going to end by being burned to death. And I remember feeling that terrible recognition. But just like that, and I was running, and then that fire devil thing kind of whipped back away from me and sucked back the other way into the burn again. The main smoke column must have pulled it back. And so then it kind of danced back to the north, and then it just whipped across the ground and just tore right out to the north, just streamed across a road and blew out past our gear and sucked a bunch of the parachutes up into the air. And just like that, 20 acres were on fire. And so like that, then when the thing was gone around me, those little fires kind of just petered out, and I ran over to the road, and we all started high-fiving and jumping around on each other and talking about what we'd just seen for a moment. The winds were like 50 miles an hour. So that was lucky. You have to say that was luck. You know, I've talked to the young smoke jumpers before, and we've talked about dangerous parts of the job, and I told them, you know, in smoke jumping, there's luck and there's skill, and if I had to choose between either one, I'd take luck every time.
Right, there's only a certain amount that's in your control.
Yeah.
So after narrowly escaping this tornado-like fire, and after high-fiving it with your fellow smoke jumpers once you realized you'd survived, then did you get right back to work?
Well, we went over to our gear pile. It was kind of in a clearing, and we got around there. The fire was going in all directions at that time, and we had heard that Jay had been burned. And so when Jay got there, we were shook up, and we saw how Jay was. So we got a helicopter in there and got Jay out. But once we got Jay out and had a bite to eat, and then the fire boss, the state person that was sort of running that fire, got us on the radio, sent a helicopter in, picked us up. Yeah, and we just backed off to a new place. Some of us went across a creek where there'd been a spot fire across that creek. We worked out that night. But yeah, we fought that fire for the next 3 days, actually, to no avail. We had a half a dozen Cat tractors cut 40 miles of line, and we lost the fire every day.
You lost every day?
Yeah, we worked hard. That Friday was when the incident happened, when people almost got burned, and then we worked Saturday, and we lost the fire after a whole day effort Saturday. It just blew up across our Cat lines. And then we lost it Sunday, and then we lost it Monday. So by Monday, it was 18,000 acres and burned by Pump Station 9 across the Richardson Highway and was headed toward Fort Greeley.
Did you finally control it?
Yeah. You might say that. One of the things about forest fires, once they get up big and rolling, you know, you got to have Mother Nature's help to control them. If we don't catch them initially and stop them, once they get rolling big, you kind of have to have a change in the weather. And we finally got a change in the weather about a week, and then got crews out and got around it. But we had to have Mother Nature's help at that point.
Mm-hmm. Well, at the age of 59, you're now the oldest smoke jumper in the 60-year history of smoke jumping. And I'm wondering if being older has changed your attitude about risk and your own mortality?
No, not really. I think as I've gotten older and seen all the different, you know, there's been losses, there's been sacrifices over time, I think it's made even more firm in my mind the notion that a life fully lived is worth dying for. If you want to experience life, if you're prone to experience life in a real intense way on the edge, as some people are, I think part of the bargain is, and this may be a self-serving sort of a rationalization, I don't know, but, you know, we believe sort of in fate. I think people that do risky things sort of do. But the overall benefit of being a smoke jumper and working with such a wonderful group of people and experiencing so many magnificent places in the wilderness and parts of the country and the fabulous characters that you get to meet and be part of, there's a price to pay, and every now and then, you know, we offer somebody up on that sacrificial altar, and it's tragic. But for me, if I live to be 200 years old, I'd jump 150 years. It's been wonderful. It's been empowering. It's transformed me. I've watched it do that to other people. They come into the experience and feeling one way about themselves, and after a few seasons as a jumper, they got a more bounce in their step, and they got a new, expanded sense of what they are.
Well, I wish you good luck, and I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, thank you, Terry. It was great to talk with you.
Murray Taylor's new memoir is called Jumping Fire. This will be his last season as a smoke jumper. Coming up, Maureen Corrigan reviews the new novel, An Obedient Father. This is Fresh Air. Short story writer Akhil Sharma recently won the Village Voice Literary Supplement's Year 2000 Writers on the Verge Award. Book critic Maureen Corrigan says, forget about The Verge. Sharma has arrived. Here's a review of his debut novel, An Obedient Father.
Even those of us who like to think of ourselves as semi-sophisticated readers can still be completely emotionally conned by a deft, unreliable narrator. I should have known better after the first few pages of reading An Obedient Father, a first novel by Indian-born writer Akhil Sharma. The narrator here is named Ram Karan. He's a government official in the Delhi school system and a good-natured bribe-taker. That fact alone should have put me on the alert. But how can you not like a guy who describes his performance at work like this? My general incompetence and laziness had been apparent for so long. I am the type of person who does not make sure that a file includes all the pages it must have, or that the pages are in the right order. I refuse to accept even properly placed blame, lying outright that somebody else had misplaced the completed forms or spilled tea on them, even though the soggy pages are still on my desk. All this is common for a certain type of civil servant who knows that he is viewed with disdain by his superiors and that he cannot lose his job. Ram is a lovable rogue, or so I thought, a kind of modern Indian offshoot of Dickens' Micawber. And that amiable impression of Ram never completely disappears, even as it's crowded aside by another, nastier picture. One evening, when Ram returns from his office to the cramped slum apartment he shares with his widowed daughter, Anita, and his 8-year-old granddaughter, Asha, he calls Asha to his bedside and casually, lovingly, begins brushing himself against her. That scene, which Sharma renders in a short paragraph, is so astonishing. I must have read it about 3 times. Afterwards, I knew that not only had I been played for a fool by Ram, but up to that point by the novel, too. Because An Obedient Father first presents itself as a comic romp through corrupt Indian politics and the lunacies of everyday life in a teeming city. But after a while, it also simultaneously begins to read like a tale of escalating psychological terror. Towards the end, I even kept thinking of Henry James's Turn of the Screw, where characters in isolated circumstances also drive themselves mad. And the fact that Sharma can keep these 2 wildly disparate moods in motion within the same novel testifies to what a fine and ruthless writer he is. A lesser novelist would have weakened and redeemed his main character, Ram, somehow. Instead, in Ram, Sharma creates a morally baffling antihero who's a testament to the oft-times geniality of evil. Back to that crucial scene. Ram's abuse of Asha is thwarted by his daughter Anita, who walks past his room at a critical moment. Shortly thereafter, we learn in stomach-turning detail that Ram repeatedly raped Anita when she was just about Asha's age. But she's stuck living with him now, because in the harsh reality of impoverished Indian society, who else is going to take in a widow and child? As their present-day relationship deteriorates into a one-on-one grapple to the death, the world around Ram also crumbles. When Prime Minister-elect Rajiv Gandhi is assassinated, Ram's political patrons scramble for power, involving him in a series of dirty deals and ultimately leaving him out front and vulnerable. In the dizzying climax of An Obedient Father, armed thugs raid Ram's apartment. Anita, like the Ancient Mariner, walks from the houses of her relatives to those of Ram's bosses, telling them of his horrible sexual crimes. And still, I found myself half rooting for this monster. Why? Because he sometimes made me laugh. Because he stepped into a mob and saved a family of Sikhs from being slaughtered. Because he knew how to make himself seductively pitiful. So by the end of reading An Obedient Father, there I was, conned again.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed An Obedient Father by Akhil Sharma. Fresh Air's senior producer this week is Roberta Sharak. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Monique Nazareth, with Patty Leswing and Megan Howell. Research assistance from Helen Wong. Anne-Marie Baldonado directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Random House Incorporated's Delta Trade Paperbacks Division, publisher of Turn of the Century, a novel by Kurt Anderson. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next archive edition of Fresh Air, Growing Up Jewish in Egypt, an interview with Andre Aciman about his memoir, Out of Egypt. In the 1960s, rising anti-Semitism and anti-Western feelings forced his family to flee Egypt. He has a new book of essays called False Papers, Essays on Exile and Memory. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.